Hi everyone, thanks for staying along or watching the video online if you watch the video online. I'm RJ, you may know me from such videos as taking apart your computer, crimping your Ethernet cable, among other great shorts. But for this review session, the plan really is to sort of, we have a lot of material prepared and we want to just help you sort of learn what you want to go over. So we've sort of put up on the screen the recap summary list, and if we can make a list of topics that we're going to go over, and then we'll just sort of go through them. So any sort of general topics in particular that you remember being confusing or you sort of don't quite have a full handle on? Anything at all?
Starting over here.
I have a question. Are we allowed to ask in terms of, I'm curious about the format of the exam.
Oh yeah, we have a slide or two about that, so we'll definitely talk about that.
Okay.
Yep, and the question was about the format of the exam, so we will go over that. If there aren't sort of broad general questions, we can sort of pick a topic and jump in, but yeah? Yep, so HDDs and SSDs, we'll definitely go over those. I'll just make a list so we remember.
Anything else from other members of the class?
Yeah, yep.
I just need to remember SATA and NATA.
Yep.
Great.
And
binary?
Yep, that's a good one.
In terms of binary, how did we feel about like converting decimal to binary, converting binary to decimal, or binary addition, sort of all of those things, or is one?
For me, all of them.
Yeah, well,
great.
So we have a prepared example for that. Anything else? And we can always sort of, yeah?
No, I was going to suggest like binary operators, but I don't know if we want to go through that.
Yeah, so the bitwise operators, so those actually were technically not going to be on the exam because they're in the section video only. But if you know, definitely, if you have any questions, feel free to ask them. But yeah, so we can do the big sort of the first few slides. Did you hit the three or four?
Let's try four.
Okay. So
go ahead.
So yeah, here is some administrivia. Administrivia is a big word for, I don't know what it means. The exam is going to be next Monday, right here, 5:30 to 7:30. It'll be 2 hours. You'll have 2 hours to complete the exam. The extension school has all sorts of policies. Tommy mentioned this in lecture, but things about if you're taking it distance, just follow those normal rules. The exam will consist of questions. The questions will be sort of probably things like fill in the blank, short answers, multiple choice, really similar in spirit to the problem set questions. And lectures 1 through 4, so the first 4 weeks of the course, will be represented relatively equally, so about a quarter from lecture 1, 2, 3, and 4, not and so on, 1, 2, 3, 4. No calculators, notes, or other aids. And the section videos, while useful in helping you sort of synthesize the information and remind yourself of things from the lectures, won't specifically be tested on the exam. In terms of like studying, I know Tommy mentioned a lot of this in his lecture component, but you know, the recaps are really helpful. The recaps are what, you know, frankly, we use to prepare these review slides, and they're a really good sort of way to review the material. I would recommend not just sort of reading through them and saying, oh, I understand that, but definitely take time to pause yourself, take a break, and see if you remember what you read 5 minutes earlier. Because it's pretty easy when you're reading it to say, oh, that sentence makes sense, I understand it. And then when you come to an exam, realize you don't remember the things that you read. So in terms of studying, I'd sort of read through a recap and then try the practice problems at the end, or maybe read the recap, leave for half an hour, maybe watch an episode of TV, or you know, eat a meal, something like that, and then go back to the practice questions after a break to see if you really remember the material. Tommy's got a question.
So the recaps also have practice questions that were not on the problem sets, so they just kind of have some additional questions that you might want to practice with. And also keep in mind the recaps do have some information that was not covered in lecture, whether just for time constraints or because it was less interesting. So if there's something in a recap that we did not mention in lecture, then you know that's not game for the exam because that's unfair. If we covered it in lecture, then that will be the exam.
Yeah. So what Tommy said was that there are practice questions at the end of the recaps that have questions that were not on the problem sets, and those are very useful for practice. And that the recaps potentially have some more detail than what was covered in lecture, And that detail is useful for extra knowledge and for really going over things that we didn't have time for in lecture, but aren't necessarily game for the exam. So if it was in lecture, it can be on the exam. If it's in a recap, but it wasn't in lecture, then you don't need to know it. It's just sort of fun. Yeah. And I would recommend going over your problem sets. So the problem sets you submit have feedback online and marking the questions you got right, which are great, and also the questions you got wrong. And so definitely look at your feedback and sort of go over the ones you got right and make sure you still know how to do them. And then especially go over the ones you got wrong to see what you did wrong and what the right answer was so that you can get it right, hopefully, on the exam. But let's sort of just talk about topics now. So one question was about HDDs versus SSDs. So I have a slide. Here we go. So an HDD in particular has a lot of mechanical components. And I know the question specifically asked about SSDs, but I might as well go over HDDs as well. So they have the magnetic platters, and the whole sort of process is in a recap. But the platters are divided into tracks and sectors. And so the magnetic head of the read-write, that'll be fun for the video. The magnetic head of the actuator arm sort of reads over the platters to read the magnetic bits off the drive, and that's a very mechanical process. Whereas the SSDs have no moving parts and are sort of flash memory, a lot like RAM. So there are no moving parts involved, and the data is just sort of read off of those, like much like you read off RAM.
I think to return your question, if you're getting at what's covered in the recap, which is a little more about NAND gates and transistors, if we didn't cover it in lecture, as Tommy was just saying, then we will not cover it on the exam.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think we talked about that level of detail. Yeah, that level of detail for SSDs, while sort of useful and fun, isn't necessarily needed for the exam.
Yep. Does that help? Yeah.
Great. So what was the next thing on our list, which I'm realizing is a short list? SATA versus PETA. So if you could hit 3, because I don't have a slide. Do you have the recap part here?
Sure.
Same one.
Oh, was this? This is a memory thing?
Just SATA.
Because I was looking here.
Yeah. Unless you did this one. Do you have a slide for this?
This is fine.
Okay.
So would you like to explain? They're both SATA and PETA. PETA also can be referred to as an IDE connector, or ways of connecting the hard drive to the motherboard. Tommy, are there specific differences that we're expecting students to know?
Well, there's just, they're different types of cables. SATA's kind of a newer version. It's faster. The cables can be longer, actually. But just, there are two different ways of connecting the hard drive to your motherboard, and pretty much all modern hard drives are SATA. But if you ever see that kind of ribbon cable, that's what it is.
Yeah, so just to say it again for the camera, the SATA and PETA are just both ways of connecting your hard drive to your sort of motherboard, but SATA is a newer type of connector, and so most hard drives these days are SATA, but if you ever see some of those older big ribbon cables, that's a PETA connector potentially. So the motherboard we looked at had both, but the sort of if you open up a computer these days, there'll be like a SATA connector and then plugged into your hard drive.
Does that answer the question? Feel free to ask follow-up questions as we talk, or once we finish covering these three things, we can ask for some more. Something else?
Acronyms.
So the question was if students are expected to know things like SATA and what that acronym stands for. And I think in general, if we defined it in class, then it would be good to know what it stands for. But things like SATA or PETA, which I don't believe we defined, then it's not as important that you know the acronym, just important that you know what they do.
Yeah,
it's more important that you know what the acronym is than what the letters actually stand for. So knowing, that SSD has to do with it's a type of hard drive versus SMTP, which is we just looked at sending emails. So just like knowing what they are, but you don't have to reproduce like what the H and DHCP stands for.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, and I'll say it again because camera. Really, it's important if you know the letters, you will likely then know what it means, and what the thing does. But if you don't know the specific letters, as long as you know that SMTP is a mail protocol, it's helpful that you remember that M and P are mail in protocol, but if you don't remember whether it's secure mail transfer protocol or simple mail transfer protocol or super mail transfer protocol, isn't super important. But definitely if it's easiest for you to just memorize all the acronyms and that's how you'll remember what each one does, then great, do that. But if it's easier for you just to remember, oh, SATA and PETA are two types of connectors and SMTP is an email thing, then that's really the level at which we want you to understand what these things do. It's much better if you can describe sort of in a couple sentences what SMTP is used for rather than just telling us what the letters stand for. And those will be the types of questions. You know, I would highly doubt that we would put like a list of acronyms and a list of things and have you match them, because realizing right now that'd be really easy because it had the letters. But we'd say, you know, SMTP, describe what it's for, you know. DHCP, potentially describe what it's for, but not just, hey, give us the acronym. That's not a useful use of our grading time, really.
Or your brain power. So shall we move on to binary?
Yeah, so you have an example.
Around
here.
30. Slide 30.
Well.
It's near the beginning.
Yeah.
So I think we'll start with just some conversion, like converting binary to decimal and decimal to binary.
Pull up one of those. Looky. Oh.
Nailed it. All right. We'll
just
start with
the screen to move to the next slide.
Oh. I do what to? Yeah, thank you. Okay, so if we have a number like this, 10101, does anyone remember what the general process we might use to convert this to decimal is? Going back to binary, this is kind of a long time ago. Yeah. Oh yeah, right here. No? Exactly. So the first bit, this one on the very right-hand side, is like the ones place. It's 2 to the 0. And the next one is like a 2's place, and then a 4's place, and then an 8's place, each one increasing by 2. So if we sort of write on the board, maybe if we were actually to do this problem on an exam, we could just take this and make our, like, can people see the chalkboard if I write over here? Write like our 5 dashes, and this is the 1's place, this is the 2's place, this is the 4's place, 8 and 16.
And if I could jump in for a second, it's very, very common, especially in a test situation, that you'll make a little mistake and say the 0's place instead of the 1's place. So definitely, and that happened a lot, you know, on the problem set, so definitely keep track and go 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, not 0, 2, 4,
yes.
8, 16.
Great reminder. So then if we look at our number, we have 5 numbers. So the first one goes here in the 1's place. We have a 0 in the 2's place. 1 here, 0 here, and 1 here. Any questions about how we got to this point? And so then just like we were adding up numbers in a decimal system, we can say a 1 in a 1's place, that has a value of 1. 0 in the 2's place, that has a value of 0. We're just going to sum these up. 4 in the 1 in the 4's place is a 4. 0 in the 8's place is 0, and a 1 in the 16th place is 16. So when we add those up, looks like we get 21. And if we look at the slide, it's the same process outlined that I did here. Do we have any questions about this? Yeah?
So it goes right to left instead of right to right?
You could think of it as either way. I think it's easiest to start from the right, because you know that this is always going to be the ones place, whereas if you have like maybe if we give you a longer binary number, this the farthest to the left might not be the 16th place, it might be the 32nd or the 64th. Yeah?
This might be stupid, but instead of writing 1, 2, 4, 8, 16,
yes, and that's almost even better because that's where these numbers are coming from. So the question was, instead of writing 1, 2, 4 for the places, could you write 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2, 2 to the 2 to the 3? And the answer is yes, that's completely correct.
And I'll just say it one more time. I see that all the time, and the people that wrote 2 to the 0 very, very, very often accidentally said, oh, 2 to the 0 is 0. So
yes.
Just as long it definitely is sort of easier and faster to write 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2, but just make sure you keep track of, well, 2 to the 0 is actually 1. And so you don't put 20 instead of 21. But yeah, no, and that's particularly useful if you want to do something other than binary. Like if we said, oh, it's base 3 or it's base 7, then it's 3 to the 0, 3 to the 1, 3 to the 2, or am I even on camera? Am I just standing off screen as a voice? Or 7 to the 0, 7 to the 1, 7
to
the 2.
Missing out if you are.
So that definitely makes it clear that you know exactly what's going on with the base system.
Any more questions on this example? So this was a pretty simple example, but it's an algorithm you can follow anytime you need to convert some binary number to a decimal number. So if it would be helpful, we'll now go on to a decimal to binary conversion example. RJ, do you want to take this one away?
It's your slide. I do it wrong, I'm sure.
All right, I'm quite confident that RJ can convert 12 to a binary number, but he's going to let me do it. So does anyone remember the process we might use when we're going from decimal to binary? Yeah.
It's the opposite. You would, you know, how many times is 12 going to 2 to the 4 or 2 to the 3?
Perfect. Yeah. So what I have here is like the five blank spaces on the slide. Do you want to do the writing?
Sure.
Nice. All right. And so we can think of it as pretty much the same way. We have our five spaces, each corresponding to like the ones place, twos place, fours place. And what we can do is just start on the left this time and say, how many times does 12 go into 16? Let's hear from one of you.
Zero
times.
So
12 into 16.
So
did I misspeak?
Yeah. 16 into 12.
I did misspeak. You're correct. But yeah. they just knew what I was trying to say, even though I was wrong. So 16 into 12, zero times. But then 8, how many times can that fit into whichever way it goes? 1. So we can just progressively move further down this binary number. And so now.
So if I put in 8.
Yes. It's important to sort of subtract that total from our previous total. Does everyone understand why we would do that?
So now we've put in this 8, we've accounted for the 8, but there's still 4 left over that we're going to want to include. And so you just have to make sure that you start big enough that you know, you've accounted for everything. So we kept going until we found a number bigger than 12. So 1 isn't bigger, 2 isn't bigger, 4, 8. 16 is bigger, so we know that's as far as we need to go. 0 16s, and then 1, 8. And now we started with 12. We've accounted for 8 of those 12, and there's still 4 left over. And now we'll keep going.
Great. Perfect way to explain it. So now that we move back to the 4's place, do we need a 4? Yes. And so once we include that 4, have we represented all of the number? Yes. So then we can just kind of see there's nothing left, so the rest of our places are going to be filled with zeros.
And so one other little detail of binary, you know, here we have written up 0, 1, 1, 0, 0. I could have said 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0. The zeros at the far left just don't matter.
Yes.
The zeros on the right are important. The zeros on the right say that this first 1 is going to be a 4 as opposed to an 8 or a 1 or a 2. So you need these two zeros to make sure that you're sort of lined up correctly, but then the other zeros don't matter.
Question.
So does that mean that you can just call it 1100?
Yes.
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 When we're talking about sort of computers and how they represent information, things are stored as bytes, which are 8 bits long. So typically you'll see these numbers sort of padded out to 8 numbers. And in some cases, a number might be 2 bytes. And we say, okay, every number is going to be 2 bytes. You're going to have, maybe 14 extra zeros or 12 extra zeros or something. This number, if I said in binary 1100, that's 12, and so on.
Yep, and so if we see the slide, kind of the same process. Would it be helpful to do, do we have any more questions on that conversion? General algorithm.
Okay. Yeah. And so any other topics now that we've sort of warmed up a bit? Are those near internet side?
No. Oh, yes, they are. Yeah. Okay. So at what level it's controlled?
So we'll.
Sure.
Are they subdomains or?
Let's find the slide. Here we go.
Are you good?
Your slide. Unfortunately. So, and we, if we actually can quote from one of the recaps here, I think. you happened to pick a slide that Ben prepared, so Ben's going to talk for a bit.
Okay. So you're just sort of asking about the DNS records and sort of these different fields that we see in those things. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And CNAME and ANAME is part of that? Okay. So I think this is the exact slide, actually, that Tommy showed in lecture. So we see that, were you wondering specifically about the CNAME and the...
Well, when you say like domain alias, I really get it. Like, is it another domain that redirects to the original?
Exactly, yes. So the question was, when we say that it's a domain alias, does that mean that it's a separate domain that aliases to the same domain? And yes, that's exactly the correct way of thinking about it.
So if you had a CNAME for, let's say, is there an example we could give?
Yes. In the recap, there's a display, which I just pulled up, of which I believe we looked at in lecture, which is like a DNS record that you might actually see on your internets. So here at the very bottom, we see these CNAME records. And we have some host name mail, which aliases to this ghs.google.com address.
So is that mail.cse1.net, Tommy? Yeah, so if we go to mail.cse1.net, it sort of aliases to Google's mail servers, and we actually end up at a sort of a Gmail-like interface. So in this case, even though Tommy owns cse1.net and he has connected it to one of his sort of servers that's serving all this content, like the recaps and the lectures and things, when he goes to mail.cse1.net, the requests are actually sent to Google and you get a Gmail-like, because Google is preparing that Gmail page, not Tommy.
Is that reflexive at all? I mean, is there any way, would Google also be able to enter dhs.blah blah blah and have that yield in CSE1?
In this particular example, Google lets you do mail.google.com/a/cse1.net. I don't know if that's always the case. Okay. Is there always a way to?
No, the server has.
So it's not necessarily the case that if you have a CNAME to a particular web server, you can actually get there another way. You may be only able to get there through this CNAME.
Question over here first, and then we'll come.
So my understanding, and I'm sure someone will jump in if I'm wrong, is that when you go to mail.cse1.net, you're sending a request to cse1.net, which is sort of configured to say, well, hold on, the mail host, that's actually this Google address, so go there instead.
Just walk across the container, like a DNS
message. Let me pull up.
You have it?
Yep. Yeah. Sure. So I think this,
wrong one.
Delightful. Take your time. So I think this slide is kind of getting at more of your point, which is a little different than CNAME, but related. So this is talking about sort of the order that we go in when we're trying to make a request, correct? So first you would go to the cache DNS server if it's not in sort of your personal hosts, right? And then if you search a few nearby DNS servers and don't find anything, that's when you move on to the root DNS server.
When you say you don't mean actually one of us, but...
But a client making a request.
Yeah, so some process that you sort of kicked off that you're no longer in charge of goes off and does all this.
Correct. Exactly. Yeah. So it's going to...
Repeat. You can't say exactly.
Oh.
Exactly what?
Yes, no, I understand. So she asked if you go to sort of a different server or a different router, and that's exactly what happens. First it checks the cache DNS server, then it checks other nearby, nearby in terms of things that server maps to, and then if after a few of those don't yield the IP address that you're looking for, then you move on to this root DNS server. Does that help answer your question? Great. And you had a question over here?
Well, going back to the
yeah.
name,
yep.
what does the alias mean? I thought you guys have said that.
Oh, sure. So alias is just, to say two things are alias means they do the same thing. So typing in male, do you want to switch back?
Oh,
typing
one
in,
that I just hit.
All right, technical difficulties.
Found it.
Typing in mail.cse1.net does the same thing as this ghs.google.com.
Yeah.
So essentially two names for the same thing.
Yeah, the word alias just means a name for the same thing.
Yeah.
So in this case, it aliases to, or mail.cse1.net is an alias for this ghs.google.com. So it's just a name for ghs.google.com.
Question. So the question is there or is there not an IP address associated with the CNAME?
So my understanding is that there will eventually be an IP address because there has to be to send a request and receive a request, but we're not in charge of it anymore. We've sort of handed off control to Google and said, hey, in this case, you know, ghs.google.com is going to sort of have its own entry and its own you know, its own server, and it's going to have its own IP address. So as far as we're concerned, if you're looking for mail.cse1.net, .net, you know, we're just going to hand it off to the next sort of guy. Yeah?
So whereas with A records, you would be handling all the IP addresses.
Right. So if we scroll up here to these A records, our DNS settings in this case, sort of we're in charge of that. It's our site. And, you know,
yes.
And
so we are completely in charge of the IP address, whether that's an A record, which would be an IPv4, or an quadruple A, which would be the IPv6. More questions on this topic or other topics? We can put up the list of recaps again.
Yeah, really anything at all.
Yeah.
We're just back to the binary real quick. Are we going to have the optical system on the exhibit?
Quite possibly, since it's been covered on a... Oh the question was, I apologize. The question was whether the octal system could be covered on the exam. And since it was covered on a problem set, I think it's completely fair. And I think it would also be fair of us, just like we kind of threw the octal system at you, to maybe give you something that was not binary, nor octal, nor decimal, and hope that you've kind of figured out more general processes for how you might work in different bases.
That being said, don't be worried about
yes.
lots of large math. Obviously, no calculators on the exam, so numbers will
yes.
be small and workable as long as you sort of...
Yeah.
You know, in sort of this realm, as opposed to the multiply 1,050 by 612.
Now, I realize we never did a binary addition problem. Is that something people would find helpful? Do we remember how to add binary numbers together? Let's raise hands if we would like to see a binary addition. All right, let's do binary addition.
Okay, you have a slide?
I do not have a slide for
okay.
this, but we have a chalkboard.
Great.
You want to talk and I'll write, or do you want me to write?
Sure, I'll talk. Through a binary, yeah, okay,
yeah.
I'll talk.
What are your favorite numbers?
In binary?
Yeah, in binary.
1011 and 0110. Will that turn out good?
I have no idea.
That'll turn out fine.
Yeah.
Okay. So one, you know, if we asked you to say add 1011 and 0110, one thing you could do is just take both of those numbers, convert them to decimal, add them, and then convert it back to binary, which would work, and you'd probably get the right answer, but it would take you presumably a lot longer, because you have to do two conversions to decimal, one conversion back to binary, and it would just take a long time. So you can actually do the entire addition, if you put a plus sign, we're doing addition, we can actually do the entire addition in the binary here. And is this something we covered in lecture, I'm thinking about? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Then let's definitely go along and keep doing this. So like sort of our standard decimal addition, we'll start on the far right, and we'll add 1 and 0. And what's 1 plus 0?
All right.
1. And that's probably the level of math. It's 1. And that's the level of math we're talking about in this.
You'll have to go up to 2, actually, and then maybe bring it back down to 0, as we're about to see.
So here, on this next one, we have 1 plus 1. And 1 plus 1 is 2, which is great and awesome, but unfortunately not one of our options in binary. We only have 1 and 0 to play with. So like when you get above 10 when adding, if you were adding, if we had 6 and 5 there, you'd get 11, and there's no way to write 11. So you have to sort of carry. In this case, 1 plus 1 is 2, which is 1, 0 in binary. So if Ben could put a 0 below and a 1 to the top left, we've sort of carried the 1, as it were. Does that step make sense? That's really the only tricky thing with binary addition. It's, other than that, it's like regular addition. So is, are we following where that carry came from? Yeah? Great, great. We keep going, and we get 1 plus 1 plus, well, 1 plus 0 plus 1, which is, again, 2.
So we'll make this bit.
So we have to do the whole 1, 0 carry thing again.
Carry the 1.
And we're going to do it one more time. But this time, again, 1 plus 1 plus 0. This time, we can't quite carry anywhere. So we'll just tack the 1 on the end. Kind of like if you were adding number, you know, if you do a decimal example, you'll see that it's actually exactly the same way. And so we get 1, 0, 0, 1. We get 1, 0, 0, 0, 1. And just to confirm, let's actually do the long process I mentioned earlier. This is 1 plus 2 plus 8 is 11. And this is 2 plus 4 is 6. And this is 1 plus 16 is 17. And 11 plus 6 is indeed 17.
So you can see that either way works, although if we set up something on the test that was in this format, we would kind of like you to do the actual binary addition and show your work with the carries, as opposed to just convert them both to decimal and then add.
Yeah. And I happen to be, you know, happen to do that one in my head because I got lucky. Normally when I do math in my head, it goes horribly, horribly wrong. So I would definitely recommend doing it sort of the right way with the carries and writing all your work down so you're less likely to make a mistake. Plus, in the off chance that you do make a mistake, if we see work that is sort of on the way to the right answer, we can give you partial credit. Whereas if you just write down a wrong answer with no indication of what you were doing, there's really no credit we can give you for work that wasn't shown. So when in doubt, sort of show your steps.
Any questions on this process?
Yeah, so binary addition actually is, it's weird the first few times you do it, and it's uncomfortable because you're carrying very, you know, lots of ones and zeros floating around, but it's actually very similar to decimal addition.
Should we do some binary subtraction, multiplication, long division? I'm just kidding. That's not coming.
Please. long division, yeah.
So other topics from the recaps that from this list?
Yeah. Was there a hand or?
Yeah.
Oh, no. So, I mean, things that we could sort of toss at you. If we threw up one of these pictures, but with just the yellow lines and no, yeah. Oh.
Today's lecture is completely fair game.
Fair game. We were here. We were listening. Yeah. So I imagine that the technical details aren't super important, but the question was about today's lecture. We went over a bunch of protocols and whether we could talk about sort of the manual sending of email, for example, because we showed an SMTP example. So. Oops. But my slide wasn't very helpful because it's telling us to go to the recap, which we will do. But so we'll pull it up in a second. But just to go over SMTP, it's the Simple Mail Transfer Protocol, and we can and when we go on to sort of gmail.com and we say we type a message and hit send, it on our behalf does a number of steps. It connects to an SMTP server of the recipient, and it prepares the headers saying who the message is from and where the message is going, and it prepares the message, and it prepares a bunch of other information that we'll see, and it sort of sends that request, it, you know, forms a connection, sets something up, you know, says data, types in all the things it needs to say, and sends it on its way. So we can actually manually do that process, but Gmail does it for us. So if we pull up the recap, which had it all typed up, and I didn't want to squeeze it onto a slide. You were control F-ing.
I sure was.
So this is, you know, an example of what is actually sent, and it's let's here hold. We can zoom. This is the headers of an email. Now what we're looking for. So
hear it. What? Oh. It's not it either.
Well, that's the connection.
Yep, logging in, logging in. Yeah, I'm looking at it.
Hello, look, there it is.
Oh, it's the whole record. Oh, because Tommy was nice. He walked us through it step by step, but here's the entire thing. So we formed a connection. We logged in with our username and password in base64, which is magic for letters and numbers and a couple other characters. It's the uppercase letters, lowercase letters, some punctuation involved there. But once you've logged in, we say mail from, and we type in who it's from. We say RCPT2, and again, the details of it, the command is mail, and the command is RCPT, aren't probably super important to memorize, but definitely recognize what they're doing here. We type in data, which is just assigned to the SMTP server that my message is about to start. It tells us to go ahead, and it pre-populates this from and to, or we type that? Okay, so we typed in, after data, we typed in from and who it's from, and to and who it's to.
Just like how we want to pretend to be Barack Obama at whitehouse.gov, we can do that here.
And we type in a subject, like I love cats, and then the body of our message. So here is just a sentence. It could have been paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs, could have had up to some limit, could have had HTML involved. And then when we're done, we hit a dot and sort of hit enter. And at that point, the SMTP server kind of sends it on its way. Yep?
So which part of that would be?
So it's important to sort of understand the steps that are going on. I mean, I would sort of, in this case, there are only a few commands. So mail RCPT data might be useful to sort of memorize, although I don't know the test, so it's hard to say for sure. But the understanding that there are these sorts of steps going on under the scenes, or under the hood, behind the scenes, when you sort of hit send in Gmail.
So basically, we're looking for understanding that there is this kind of two-way communication going on. Like, first thing you say is an L from, then you say receive to, but we're not looking for the actual, the letters you must type in order to be valid.
Yeah.
It's kind of at a conceptual level. Like, you're having a conversation with the server, and you're exchanging messages that include information, like who it's going to, where it's coming from. But not, you're not going to be asked to specifically say that, RETR is how to retrieve something on a POP server. But just there is a message you can send that would do that.
So just again, for the camera, we have confirmation that we're really looking for a conceptual understanding that here is what is possible, here is the way in which it works. It's a two-way communication in some cases, it's a one-way communication in others. But we're not really looking for, could you on command say RETR to get a message from a POP server? Just understand that POP is how you get a message from a server, and that there is a command for getting a message, but that it's RETR is not the level of detail we're hoping that you memorize, just the overall picture.
Another question.
When you do the mail from at the top, and then you put the username, when you go into the data and then say mail from or mm-hmm. from the username, does it have to be the same? Like, is that a way that you can fish or change the?
Yep. So. So in the Barack Obama spoof, was it just the second one or was it both?
Just two, sorry.
Yeah, so when you say mail from, the very first one, that's actually where it's coming from. Yes, no, maybe? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they can be different.
Right, and the second one is the one that's sort of displayed, and it's the one that Gmail uses to sort of pre-populate and show you where it's coming from. And so that's how you would spoof, and they don't have to match is the short answer. The Barack Obama spoof being an example of that.
Another question?
How do you pull up
Right, so this actually, we went into, on a Mac, you'd go to the terminal. On a Windows computer, mm-hmm. you can go to sort of the command prompt or another program like a terminal. So the question was, how do you get to the terminal? The terminal is just a program on Macs in particular that allow you to enter sort of commands and interface with the computer a little more directly. So if you zoom out and pull it up, yeah. You want to zoom?
Control. Cool.
So
oh,
If we just search for terminal on a Mac, it'll show up. Otherwise, we go to the applications menu.
Yep.
And here we've got a full screen terminal. If I make it smaller, oops, this is what you'd probably see the first time you open it. Something sort of small and with much smaller font. And then this is sort of an interface you can type, you know, type in commands to your computer a little more directly.
So when you've seen this interface in lecture, like when Tommy did Traceroute or some of the things today, you could do the same thing if you have a Mac or Linux just by pulling up a terminal and running those same commands.
Yeah, just to make it super clear, you wouldn't use sort of Google Chrome or Safari. Those are like the web browser that allow you to go to gmail.com. If you want to do some of these more technical under the hood things, you'd be in a terminal here. Yeah. Yeah, so Windows PCs typically have something called the command prompt.
Or DOS prompt? Or
yeah, or one of the, or the DOS prompt, which allows you to sort of have a similar interface to your computer, although some of the commands may be slightly different. Is there a question over here?
Yeah, no, it's a
okay. Yeah. But in particular, in the case of this email example, we the very first thing we did in the terminal was ran a command like this, which, again, the technical details don't really matter, but what we're saying is, you see in there, connect gmail.com SMTP, right, among other things. So this command to the terminal says, hey, open up a connection to smtp.gmail.com, and then it replies with a bunch of things. We went through the whole login process, but this is how you would, from the terminal, start a connection.
Do we have any other questions on today's material, now that we know that that's fair game for the review session?
Scroll out a bit. So I do think, sorry, just, if you're going to navigate, don't be zoomed in. But the, I think the most important thing we covered today was probably memes. I'd study those. They're great for procrastinating. But in terms of other topics, we did, you know, we prepared slides for all the things we thought you might ask about, so we'll definitely post those. They're useful. They're sort of a skimmed down version of the lecture slides so that you don't have to go through, you know, 400 lecture slides while trying to study. Although you definitely, I would recommend that you reference them. If you're going through a recap or one of our review slides and you find something you don't sort of fully understand, you can pull up Tommy's lecture slides and dive into those. But we'll also be posting our full review slides, which have a section for each lecture. We just thought it would be a more useful use of time to go over what you want to talk about other than we want to talk about. Yeah?
Is there anything specific with the sections you want
us to? So the sections are really designed to just sort of, you know, allow you to get more familiar with sort of the material and also sort of to explore some potential applications of material. In terms of the exam, only lecture content, although feel free to watch the sections if you find them sort of useful for synthesizing concepts and seeing a real world example of, you know, well, you know, what Ethernet is or what a motherboard is or things like that. But the lectures in particular are if it's in a lecture, it could be on the exam. If it's in a section, it may or may not be, if it was in lecture, I should say. So.
Do we have a problem set for today's lecture? For next week?
So did you talk about it at all?
So I'll send out an email with how that's gonna work.
I can say I'm on mic, so. Yeah, so basically there'll be...
You want a mic?
Okay.
Yeah, so there'll be a problem set released. It won't be due until the next Monday we have lecture, which is actually a few from now because of spring break. But if you submit a version of it before, was it Friday? Before Friday, we can promise qualitative, not quantitative, but qualitative feedback for Monday. So. Just so that you have seen sort of the right or wrong answers for the exam, and then you can resubmit before the real deadline if you so choose. So if you happen to be able to get it in by Friday, we'll take them in Friday, Saturday, and grade them over the weekend, so you actually can receive that qualitative feedback because the material on this released problem set is fair game for the exam. So that's an offer we're making. But the actual due date of the problem set will be the Monday of the fifth lecture, which is March 25th, I believe, which is reminding me how, you know, quickly the semester's been going. But yeah, we have exam this Monday, spring break the following Monday, and then the problem set would be due lecture 5 after that.
Any questions on that process? that's kind of
and Tommy's going to send an email detailing all that, so don't worry about remembering any of it, but just so you guys know. Any other topics? Things like these.
And just to be clear, this isn't going to be like a problem set designed to take you 3 weeks. This will still be the same like problem set that you're used to.
Yeah, so Tommy said, and it will be in the email anyway, but the problem set is not a 3 week mega problem set, you know, stay up all night for weeks at a time. It's going to be a regular problem set designed to take 1 week. It's just that week happens to be a few weeks from now as opposed to this week. Because we like spring break too. Anything else? Any other topics at all? Any questions? Questions for us? Questions about? Yeah.
I just had a question about problem set 3, where I forget what the tool was that we used the website, but where we look, you know, where McDonald's is, MLB.com, the class website. Was the MLB.com in Frankfurt, or was that just my? Granted, a few times I couldn't figure out why it wasn't, you know, going anywhere.
So that was a question about a problem on the problem set.
I don't remember.
And Tommy doesn't remember the answer either. It was something about where is MLB.com sort of go to. We can actually give it a try to talk about that. Feel like trade chat? Yeah, click the link. Oh, we won't work here, will it, Tommy? So if that's indeed the case, we'll...
So for the camera, when everyone was doing the problem set, they got stuck in Frankfurt.
So I'm hearing... When I saw the problem set, there was only CSE1 and McDonald's.
Shall we wrap?
If it did work for the first two, I would sort of use that as your sort of conceptual guidance for the exam. In terms of the third one, if something weird happened, we'll, you know... Just ignore it, as it were.
No, you have to play a tweet for like 30 seconds or like a minute or so.
Oh, so that.
All right.
Yeah, no, when I travel, I tend to wait a long time in Frankfurt as well.
All right, so we'll stick around in case there are any more questions. You're welcome to come up and talk with either one of us, but I think. Our formal review session is now over. Good luck on the exam next week.
Yeah, we'll see you Monday.